You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
2008 will be remembered as one of the most fascinating years in American political history and included an extremely unpopular sitting president, a fight to the finish for the Democratic presidential nomination between Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, the swift and dramatic downturn of not only the U.S. economy but the global one as well, the emergence of Sarah Palin, and finally, the election and its aftermath. The often excellent coverage of those and other top stories of the year seems to have made the job of selecting the pieces to include in this year's Best American Political Writing more challenging than usual. From this year's collection, which was edited by Royce Flippin, we're joined now by three contributors, John Heilman, Jane Mayer, and Todd S. Purdom, who also wrote the introduction. The book is published by Public Affairs, and I'm pleased to welcome them to the show today. Hello.
Hi.
And Todd, can you hear us?
Thank you.
And I'm throwing this out to all of you first. Did you feel that this was a special year, or is it all the same, just practicing the craft of journalism?
Greatest year ever, Leonard.
Really? You felt that way?
Yeah, I think for a lot of people, when we started, at least on the campaign side, a lot of people started this campaign with a perception that it would be a great year because there were not any incumbents running, and that was a kind of historically unusual situation. And as the campaign progressed, you know, both with the epic primary fight between Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, McCain's incredible comeback from 2007 to get the nomination, I think most reporters who covered the campaign looked up every day and said, wow, this is 10 times better than we thought it was, and we thought it was going to be great.
I mean, you've got even people like David Broder, who've been covering campaigns for decades and decades, who described this is his last campaign before he retires, is the best one he's ever covered. So,
Todd, the Bush administration has been noted for its tight control of information. Did that change? Did they loosen up a bit this year?
I don't think they overtly loosened up, but by this year, enough people had left the administration, and there were enough people who were dissatisfied with the way things had gone, that you were able to find cracks in that facade, and there were, I don't want to say, malcontents, but there were people who, in some cases, had really wrenching discussions with their own conscience and were speaking out. People like Matthew Dowd, the president's former pollster, Scott McClellan obviously made big waves with his book about his own experiences in the White House.
And was attacked roundly for it.
Yes.
This was that same dynamic's been really important for me covering things like the CIA, because there are people who left the CIA in horror at the things like the torture program, and tracking them down and finding them is the only way you can learn about these programs.
It is amazing it took that long, though, right, Shane? I mean, it's kind of incredible how tight they held it. I mean, they managed to really keep leaks from happening in that administration for like 6 years before the facade, as Todd said, started to kind of break down a little bit.
They really did, but part of the reason was that they've made so many things an issue of national security, so that they've made people feel that if they spoke, they might somehow endanger America for telling the truth about what was going on.
Well, they were made to feel that they were not only traitors to the country, but traitors to their party, or at least to the administration.
Right.
Jane, I understand that you're being honored tomorrow at Columbia University School of Journalism for your reporting. Todd, is your cell phone going?
Nope.
Somebody's cell phone is.
I think it's mine over in the corner.
I'll let it go. No, let him.
I'm so sorry.
It's okay. It's just so weird these days we have to worry about those things. You're being honored at Columbia University School of Journalism for your reporting on the War on Terror and your collection of articles. The Dark Side has been nominated for the National Book Award. Congratulations.
Thanks so much. Yeah, it's a kind of immoral to be getting so much attention for writing about such dark, terrible things. But it's a shame you have to write about these things, but I'm glad that I could do it. So.
And in this collection, it's your pieces on black sites?
Right, that's right, about the CIA's black site prisons.
And that was published on August 13th, 2007, in The New Yorker. Has the situation changed at all in the 14 months since?
Yeah, it has.
Do you think that the articles played a role?
Hard to tell. I mean, I think that, in fact, that what played a far greater role was the United States Supreme Court saying that the activities that were taking place in that program were war crimes, and there was immunity for what happened before, but not afterwards. That pretty much shut down the program. Though it's interesting, Vice President Cheney has insisted on keeping those black prisons open just in case, and he has, and they still remain open just in case. Nobody's in them, as far as we know right now. Most of the people have been transferred to Guantanamo.
John, the piece you wrote that was selected for this collection is about the McCain campaign this past April, when his Gallup poll approval rating was 67%, but the turnout at some of his events was quite low. You asked, is John McCain Bob Dole? Now, were people actually asking that question?
No, I think I may have been the first person to ask that question in any sustained way. And, you know, it struck me. I mean, I covered the 96 campaign and had followed Dole around a lot, so I guess I started to see those parallels. And in a funny way, you know, McCain had run in 2000 as having been this kind of iconoclastic, you know, independent maverick character. And by the time he ran in the primaries, he had become the candidate kind of the party establishment. He was a candidate who seemed to care a lot more about endorsements than ideas. And you wondered whether he was getting this mainly because the Republican Party traditionally is the party of primogeniture. You know, it's the next guy in line. And there were Republicans who worried about that. And that was a starting point for the piece. But, you looked at him in a lot of very obvious ways, you know, a war hero, physically debilitated in a way that kind of accentuated his age. I mean, even though those scars were kind of, you know, got courageously in war, but they made him look older. His kind of ironic detachment from what he was doing. He would often sort of seem to be winking and kind of offering a sidelong kind of commentary about the absurdity of politics. That was something that Dole did. It was actually very charming. You know, on the other side, on the non-charming side, you know, he'd also become very much captured by, he had a lot of lobbyists around him. He'd become this kind of creature in some ways of corporate inside Washington. And you could sort of start to draw a parallel line between the two of them. And so that's kind of what I did. As it turned out, in various ways, he ended up being even more Dole-like than I thought he would. You know, I didn't ever imagine that you would have McCain doing the equivalent of what Dole did in 96, where he would be yelling, "Where's the outrage?" You know, and there was this way in which Dole deeply had no respect for Bill Clinton in 1996. And that was very much true of McCain and Obama. And the sense that they both had that the media was against them, that the media was in the pocket of the liberal candidate, that really came through. And the rage that they both felt at the end of their campaigns was also a real common trait that turned out to be even truer than I expected.
And it's surprising because both of them had been darlings of the media.
Yes, it's true.
Although especially John McCain.
Yes, especially John McCain. And, you know, I think that was a huge shock to him when, over the summer, what he thought of as his base started to treat him not with kid gloves, but with the normal degree of skepticism that most journalists bring to a front-running or standard-bearer for their party in a general election.
So is the answer then that, yes, he is Bob Dole? And did they
or
collapse
did
in
become,
the same way?
Did they make him into Bob Dole?
Well, I think historically that there's a lot of commonalities. I think people will look back on them as very similar kinds of candidates. I think in the end, you know, if you look at the most meta level, you know, Obama came, you know, embodied the future. And in a way that Clinton in 96 with his bridge to the 21st century did, you know, at the simplistic level. And both Dole and McCain looked like creatures, not creatures of the future, they looked like creatures of the past. And I think that hurt them both enormously in those races.
I'm glad you brought up Bill Clinton, because Todd, didn't you get a lot of heat for your piece in Vanity Fair on Bill Clinton, the comeback id?
I did take a certain amount of heat for that piece, including heat from the former president himself. In some ways, the issues that piece raised have returned to the fore now with the notion that Senator Clinton might be Secretary of State. And you'll see that the past 2 days' newspapers have been full of discussion of how President Clinton might have to untangle some of his foundation's dealings, some of his private business dealings around the world, in order to avoid potential or perceived conflicts of interest should she become Secretary of State. And that's really that's really why that piece was commissioned in the first place. It was frankly commissioned on the assumption that Senator Clinton might well be the nominee and those questions would come up. And, you know, they are coming up now in a very real way.
Do you get different reactions now that you work for Vanity Fair? Would that piece have generated as much mail if you'd written it for your old boss, the New York Times?
Well, I think it would have been hard to write that particular piece for a daily newspaper because there was a certain subjective quality to it. People do react, sort of on the merits of the piece, I think, but I definitely get a different reaction working for Vanity Fair than I did for the New York Times. And people say things to me like, "Oh, I read that at my mother-in-law's over Christmas," or "My wife takes that magazine," or something like that. But the truth is, we have very good circulation in Washington and very good newsstand sales here. And whether people like to acknowledge reading Vanity Fair or not, a lot of Washingtonians read it, and I don't seem to have any appreciable trouble getting people to return my calls.
Well, it may be just a coincidence, but the three of you all work for magazines. Jane for The New Yorker, John for New York, and you for Vanity Fair. And I guess that gives you the time to write a little more completely and write the sort of thing that will get you included in a collection like this.
That's
well, I think
really
one of the realities about magazine writing, especially in a time like this when there is so much information out there in the blogosphere and elsewhere, is that magazines allow time for sort of deeper, richer storytelling. They allow you time to prowl around and maybe in unexamined corners the way Jane did with her stories on torture. And the more I get away from newspaper writing, the more I realize in some ways how unnatural newspaper writing really is. You don't sit down around your dinner table and tell the story the way an inverted pyramid story is told, with spilling all the best stuff at the beginning. You kind of build a rhythm and you say you won't believe what happened. And it's much more natural to tell stories the way magazine stories are told, frankly.
Excuse me. I mean, both these stories that they've done were sort of zeitgeist-changing stories. I mean, John's story really brought a much more critical look at McCain, I think, and Todd's story
is about suddenly was inside Bush's bunker.
Yeah, I mean, and Todd's story, the view, at least the one on Clinton, changed. He was originally going to be this great asset, everybody thought, and it was just changed everybody's thinking about, oh my God, he's baggage. Mm-hmm. And I think magazine pieces can really change people's thinking in a kind of a deep way. I mean, even more, it's funny because this long form of journalism, if anything, is disappearing more with all of the web kind of reporting. But the biggest impacts have been either magazine pieces, and actually there have been a number of books. You think of Tom Ricks's book on Iraq that have really hit hard.
And it's interesting. I'm actually right now working on, just starting to really get to work on a book about the campaign. And it's funny to going around to editors when we were selling this book, my co-author and I, people would say, well, isn't this the most overcovered election in the world? There's more coverage than ever with the blogs and everything. Why would, how could there be anything relevant about doing a Teddy White-style book on the campaign? And I keep saying to people, as you start to talk about it, you say, well, I actually think there's more necessity for that kind of thing. And this relates to the magazine pieces, too. There's so much of this coverage, but so much of it is, A, totally unreported, and B, completely ephemeral. And in some ways, some really fundamental questions about the campaign. How did Barack Obama actually decide to run for president? What did the president, did Bill Clinton and his wife actually say to each other about their campaign? The real interior stuff about what the relationships were like inside these campaigns. For all the coverage, we know less about that stuff now than we did in the 60s and 70s. These candidates are more remote, despite the fact there's more coverage. And so I think, to Jane's point, magazine pieces, and to Todd's point, magazine pieces give us a chance to at least get closer to that than all of the daily tittle-tattle does.
I was just going to add to that, which was that one of the things that I found, at least also in just doing a book recently, was that an awful lot of news reaches the audience out of order. You learn a little piece when a revelation breaks. So in the stuff that I've been covering, having to do with human rights abuses and detainees and interrogations, you'll see something like the pictures of Abu Ghraib in the spring of 2004. But who knows, how did that happen? And so what you can do in long-form journalism is connect the dots and restore the cause and effect between what happened in Washington and why you're looking at this stuff happening or spreading out around the world.
Because we get it all piecemeal.
Yeah.
Todd, in your case, you wrote the piece that's in the collection. It's called Inside Bush's Bunker, and that was from October last year. His approval rating is even lower now than it was then. It's plunged below even Richard Nixon's. How low do you think it can go before he leaves office, or do you think he's leveling out now?
It seems to me that people, have just I don't know how he could go any lower, really. The market sort of discounted that stock. But I was talking, we're doing a project now at Vanity Fair, which is an oral history of the Bush administration, getting people to offer their recollections from inside and outside the administration about the last 8 years. And I was talking to Matthew Dowd, the president's former pollster, who made the point that the president really never recovered in the public image, never really recovered at all from Hurricane Katrina and the terrible toll that took on his credibility and reputation for competence. He was supposed to be the first MBA president, and he turned out to be, presiding over a wholly inadequate response to the drowning of a major American city. So, yes, I think that, President Bush has always been a little bit unusually hunkered and bunkered compared to past presidents, and part of that has to do with the 911 security cocoon, but part of it's just his own predilection, and I think that's only increased. That's only increased this year, and his actual public appearances during the campaign tapered off to virtually nothing. So few that Peggy Noonan, you know, said he was like the little bird in the cuckoo clock who came out every once in a while and no one even paid attention.
Yeah, so it was better than Dick Cheney. Dick Cheney at least made that one very helpful appearance for John McCain at the end of the campaign. I like that. I like that too. He like saved it all up and then scheduled a special time to come out and offer his endorsement. So helpful.
His endorsement, exactly.
So helpful.
We're talking about some of the pieces that are included in this year's Best American Political Writing from Public Affairs. It's an annual that's published by that company, and it's put together by Royce Flippin. With us are Todd Purdom, who also gave us the introduction to it, and John Heilemann and Jane Mayer. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Later in the show, hear about a hoax that was perpetrated by a newspaper in 1830s New York, convinced many New Yorkers that the moon was inhabited by fantastical beings. Also, a history of American cemeteries, and we get an insider's perspective on the trial and execution of Saddam Hussein. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. We're talking about some of the pieces included in this year's Best American Political Writing, edited by Royce Flippin, with an introduction by Todd S. Purdom. And some of the other people included are John Lee Anderson, and David Bromwich, Amanda Fortini, David Halberstam, Ryan Lizza, David Mamet, David Margalek, George Packer, Joe Stiglitz, and the three people that I'm talking with. I didn't mention all the names because I could go on for the whole afternoon, but three people I'm talking with: Todd Purdom, Jane Mayer, and also John Heilemann. And Todd, the crux of your piece is that from the beginning, President Bush had an us-against-them mentality, and that it isolated him more than most presidents. All presidents wind up with this feeling that the press is against them, don't they?
Yes, they do. And in fact, one of the things that I set out to do, my editor, Cullen Murphy at Vanity Fair, suggested I really try to portray to people that the White House is, under every president, first and foremost, and we forget this, it's a military installation. The largest part of the White House staff is the military office, which runs communications and transportation and all sorts of aspects, including, you know, sending anonymous shoppers to grocery stores in Washington to buy food for the White House mess and for Air Force One.
Anonymous shoppers so that nobody will poison them?
Exactly, so that it's created a completely random thing so that no one can, you know, people don't go shopping in a White House uniform lest anyone try to monkey with the food. But, you know, there are water filters that filter all the water coming into the White House and special air filters that do the same thing. And people forget that it's first and foremost basically a fortified military compound with a secure, bomb-proof underground bunker where Vice President Cheney famously went on 9-1-1 to run the government while the president was flying around on Air Force One till it seemed safe to come back to Washington.
It's all like your house, isn't it, Todd?
What?
That's all like your house, isn't it?
Yeah, it's not like my house, I'll tell you that. Although there was a period, we live on a street in Northwest Washington where for a time we lived halfway between Karl Rove and Tom Ridge, and there was a lot of heavy security on our street, and my wife used to joke that the good news was that petty crime was down, but the risk of annihilation was way up.
Well, Barack Obama has said that he wants a more inclusive presidency, but near the end of the campaign, didn't we see him develop some kind of a bunker mentality as well?
I think that the secret of the press covering Obama is that a lot of the editors loved Obama. The reporters who were actually on the plane had a lot of complaints because they couldn't get access to him. There's just this, it's kind of some kind of natural tendency to get isolated, and it gets so exaggerated when you're in the White House. That's why it's so important to have staff that will tell you if you're making mistakes and be the kind of personality that will listen, because you're no longer out in the real world when you're in that place.
And Barack Obama was really accessible before when he went around on his book tours. Everybody loved him. The same with John McCain. And then John McCain does this ridiculous thing where he blows off David Letterman. Do you think that was because he was developing a bunker mentality or because his advisors were telling him that he had to do something else?
Well, I think by that point, I mean, I think that was a period of considerable chaos around McCain, you know, right after the financial crisis started, and they were trying to figure out if he was going to, quote, suspend his campaign or not. I think it was obviously a mistake, but it was part of a bigger pattern, right, because McCain had already closed off access to the famous, you know, the couches up in the front of the plane that they'd installed so they could recreate the Straight Talk Express, which they never used. I mean, they built this living room setting for him on his plane that no reporter ever got a chance to sit in, because by the time they were built, the campaign had decided that it was too risky to put him in those spontaneous circumstances that had got him so much goodwill back in 2000. But it's true of both candidates, and I think that that's, you know, one of the great changes is that in a lot of ways, we saw this year that the campaign trail is not where the campaign takes place anymore, and you now see increasingly, you know, it takes place over the internet in the form of the campaigns lobbing volleys at each other via email, via rapid response. It takes place on the cable news networks through surrogates. The events don't matter that much. I mean, they matter in the sense of Obama creating a sense of – his huge crowds created the sense of momentum and movement. But in terms of where the actual conflict happens, it's not – they don't do press conferences anymore really on the road. And the events themselves are hardly ever covered or hardly ever important. So it's a weird thing to be out there because you feel like you're actually further away from the action than if you stayed home.
And they also limit the areas of debate. Jane, were you surprised that the issue of torture, what it is and whether it's an appropriate method to extract intelligence, wasn't more of an issue during the presidential campaign?
Well, I mean, it did come up at one point on Meet the Press. It was asked about, or at least in one of the debates, I guess, it was brought up as a question. But what was not was any kind of serious follow-up about, well, what do we do then? I mean, it's easy to say you're against torture, but what do you do about Guantanamo? There are all these people down there, and you can't bring them back inside of the court system. What are you going to do with them? What are we going to do with people like KSM, you know, who are serious terrorists? And so that debate did not take place. And, yeah, I mean, I think it's a failure of the press, frankly, to not be able to press it further, make these questions be answered, and to follow up on each other's questions in ways that get answered.
You mean during the debates? The people who led those debates sometimes, I felt, let us down.
They did. They didn't.
They often wound up on trivia rather than the really important things, or they asked such generalized questions that any kind of answer would have been okay.
I think also the press really has to back each other up in demanding more press conferences, right, so that these questions can be put to people.
Well, Jane, you make a really good point, and there are two ways in which the press doesn't back each other up. One is in an actual press conference, it's relatively rare to have a questioner sort of follow up the predecessor's question in a way that would shed greater light. Everybody has his or her predetermined question. They want their moment to ask the question they have. It would be much better if we all acted as interlocutors for each other, and, you know, if I felt that you didn't get a good answer, I said, but what Jane just said, how about that? That's one thing. Another thing is that I think newspapers in particular are very reluctant to follow other newspapers' scoops unless they absolutely have to. And there's a way in which institutions don't use all the reporting that's out there to build a mosaic of available knowledge, and that's something that you can do in your longer pieces or in your book. You take the entire known universe of knowledge and then do your own original reporting on top of that. And I think often there's way too much sort of, to use that old term from 911, stovepiping of information in which the New York Times relies on its stories and the Washington Post on its, and they don't try to build on each other's stories.
It's one of the great problems with this decline of the campaign, and straight in this context of the campaign, I agree with Todd completely. It's one of the great problems with this decline of the campaign trail. I mean, one doesn't want to romanticize the 60s and the 50s and the 70s, but the truth is the candidates are less accountable now. Throughout a campaign, less accountable to us, and therefore, you know, to the extent that we're proxies for the public, they're much less accountable than they've ever been before. And I think if there's one way in which this campaign was really a disappointment, it's that both of these candidates who supposedly represented so much of transparency and openness were in fact much less accountable and much less willing to stand up and take questions than any two presidential candidates, I think, in history.
You know, I was just going to say, I think that I totally agree with them. At the same time, I have to say that I think that one problem is that when the press does finally get access in press conferences, they sometimes ask and jump on such sort of silly, trivial, gotcha matters. I was just thinking of the first serious press conference that Obama gave after he became, you know, president-elect. And, you know, the issue that came out of that was whether he had dissed Nancy Reagan by talking about whether or not she was going to be he didn't want to bring fortune tellers into the White House.
And the dog.
And the dog. But on the Nancy Reagan something. All I wanted to say was that as someone who had covered the Reagans, first of all, that what you're seeing there is just a little moment of Obama's sense of humor, okay? And it's as if you're not, as a politician, allowed to flash a little sense of humor and be a little irreverent. That's why we don't get to see the politicians as real people, because when they do show themselves as real, they get in trouble because of the way we treat them.
And that's a place where I have, you know, some sympathy with McCain, because they were very upset about the fact that the bloggers were constantly looking for taking out of context any small thing he said. And I had some sympathy for that, because that is, in fact, what a lot of the press corps does.
My guests are John Heilman, Jane Mayer, and Todd Purdom, three of the contributors to this year's Best American Political Writing from Public Affairs. It's edited by Royce Flippin. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. I'm really interested in this whole business about press conferences, because it does seem to me that what reporters do is they go in there, especially the television reporters, they go in there with the question that's going to get them on their nightly news. And so it has more to do with me making a splash than it has to do with getting any real information from the person that they are, who's giving the press conference. And how do we get past that?
Well, I think, you know, if there were more press conferences, each one would matter less. Each person would be less concerned about getting a huge attention. I don't know. It's a problem. I mean,
you talked about President Bush's bunker mentality. He chose how many press conferences he gave, didn't he? And also then somebody would come out at a certain point and say, okay, that's it.
Yes, no, I mean, I'm right about this, John, that he had fewer press conferences than any modern president since the advent of the press conference. I feel sure that that is true.
I believe that's true, Todd, and I think it will be another interesting test of the Obama administration. He's saying right now that he's going to do regular press conferences. I believe that every president who's ever been elected has said that, and most of them have gone back on it. It'll be interesting to see whether he does something like a monthly press conference, which would, I think, in the way that you suggest, improve the problem that Leonard's talking about.
Now, you mentioned, John, in your piece that Karl Rove tried to inject himself into the McCain campaign.
He did.
Didn't he wind up anyway because so many of his surrogates working for John McCain?
Inject is the wrong phrase. I mean, certainly there was a back channel that went between Karl Rove and many of his, as you say, former staffers and former acolytes from the Bush campaign in 2004. Steve Schmidt, the chief strategist for McCain's campaign, was someone who ran rapid response and opposition research for Rove in the past. So there was a back channel. And most importantly, Rove was the person who came to John McCain when McCain was deciding who was going to be his vice president. And he was the one who had to deliver the news that if he put Joe Lieberman on the ticket, that he would not get Joe Lieberman through the convention. And in some ways, and not to blame Rove for everything that went wrong with the McCain campaign, that piece of news, which was undoubtedly true, was what led to Sarah Palin.
Mm-hmm. Sarah Palin does seem to have been one of the biggest mistakes that John McCain made.
Just a fascinatingly suicidal move, and it happened in a kind of a, you know, unthought through way at the last minute. I mean, I tried to add up the amount of time that McCain had spent with Sarah Palin before picking her to be vice president of the United States with him, and it's definitely under 3 hours. I think it's almost under 2 hours. Face to face, they'd hardly ever set eyes on each other.
So what happens when a journalist realizes that? I mean, is that just the kind of personal insight that we all have? I'm at home and I read the paper and I say to the person with me, hey, did you notice this?
Or, well, I mean, if I went back and tried to write a piece called the Pick, it was about how did they find Sarah Palin and what brought her to the national attention, and the story turned out to be kind of amusing, because really one of the things that brought her to the national attention was a series of cruise boats where conservative pundits who'd been going up to Juneau, Alaska on these conservative cruises would get off and go and visit with her in the governor's mansion, and she was really charming apparently in person, and they all seemed to develop crushes on her. I mean, talking to people like Bill Kristol, I mean, he really sounded like he was drooling practically. It was hilarious.
Todd.
I was just going to say, John, returning to your sort of, was McCain Bob Dole? I think it was a really keen insight that you had last spring, because in 1996, John McCain was for Bob Dole what Joe Lieberman and Lindsey Graham were for him this year. That is to say, a Sancho Panza to the quixotic candidate who didn't seem to have much chance of winning. And 2 years ago, when I was spending a lot of time with McCain writing a piece about him during the midterms of 2006, He recalled being in Russell, Kansas on the day of the 1996 election when they all knew Bob Dole was going to lose, and he talked about the enormous reception that Dole's hometown gave him. And we were alone in a small plane, and I looked up and I realized McCain's eyes were full of tears. And I said, do you miss that you don't have a hometown? And he laughed and he said, you know, I can't go back to the Panama Canal Zone where I was born. But it was clear that he really respected Dole for doing that and for sticking true to himself. And in a strange way, McCain cannot be said to have done the same thing in his campaign. He got all lurchy toward the last 3 months, and the Palin pick is a perfect example of that. And I think it's one of these things where he really wound up hurting his reputation by the kind of campaign he ran.
I think it's worse than that, Todd. I think it's not just that he got lurchy. I think, you know, I don't think I've ever said about a presidential candidate, no matter how mean or nasty they've been, I don't think I've ever seen someone do something that I thought was a disqualifying thing for the presidency.
In the way he did with Palin.
And I think the Palin pick was disqualifying. It was a deeply unserious, deeply unthought-through thing. And for a 72-year-old who's had cancer three times, it was profoundly irresponsible.
And many Americans read it that way.
But that said, many did, but in the very beginning, the first couple of weeks after she was chosen, it was considered a master stroke. I mean, and there are, you know, she has her section of admirers, certainly, and I don't think she's necessarily going to depart the national stage. We could debate it.
But that's press criticism, right? To me, what that was two weeks in which the press forgot that the fundamental question we should ask about vice presidents is this person qualified to be president?
I think that the Palin story is a tremendous advertisement for the press in a way, because I don't think they were able to get to her to interview her in a way where they could ask her serious questions for a little while. She was so carefully managed. And When Katie Couric and a couple others finally did get to question her, I think they showed the American public that she was, in the eyes of many, not ready. And I think they performed a role that shows that they have a real public service to perform there.
Katie Couric didn't make it into this book, but I think that her image was enhanced incredibly by that one interview.
She was the perfect person to conduct it, too. And I think the McCain campaign, and I have heard that Palin thought that one of the reasons they chose to do that second interview after she had done Charlie Gibson first, one of the reasons was that Palin thought that because Katie Couric was a woman, she might go easier on Palin. And it turned out that Katie Couric's femininity and the fact that she was seen as a softball thrower actually put her in a perfect position to perform the vivisection that she did.
Now, you all said that you thought 2008 was a great year. I am going to predict that 2009 is going to be quite spectacular, because we have Obama talking about reversing a number of the executive orders that were issued by President Bush. There's the health care mess, two wars, the economy, rising deficits. I think there's going to be a lot to write about. What do you think?
I think just the economy is going to be in such a dramatic lurch right now, to use that word again here. That there's lots to cover, and certainly watching Obama, somebody who, you know, such a newcomer to Washington, run the country in these times is going to be amazing.
Thank you all so much for being with us.
Thank you, Leonard.
Jane Mayer, Todd Purdom, John Heilman. They are three of the, I don't know how many journalists, but there's quite a few represented in the book Best American Political Writing, edited by Royce Flippin and published by Public Affairs.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Up next, we learn about a spectacular newspaper hoax that was perpetrated in 1830s New York, when many New Yorkers were duped into believing that the moon was inhabited. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.